Show me the money.
This is the Money Web Be a Better Investor podcast, picking the brains of professional investors on their investment strategies, successes, and mistakes. Your host, Rake Fanica.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Be a Better Investor podcast. My name is Rake van Niekerk, and in this podcast series, I speak to leading professional investors about their investment journeys. We look at their first investments and how their investment strategies have changed over the years. We also look at their personal portfolios to see whether they practice what they preach. And the idea is to find those golden nuggets of wisdom to help amateur retail investors to become better investors. My guest today is Arno Lawrence. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Sasfin Asset Managers. He has been in the business for nearly three decades, and he has worked at several of the top asset managers in the country. And these include Sanlam, Coronation, Old Mutual, Atlantic, Ashburton, and now Sasfin. Arno, thank you so much for joining us. You've been around. How different or divergent is the investment strategies of different asset managers? Let's kick off with that.
Yes, it's been a long, I won't say checkered career. Hopefully there's, you know, been more ups than downs. But I think, you know, the different investment houses, I mean, I've learned a lot from each one. You know, as you go through your career, you're learning, you're getting insights, you know, and I've worked at the biggest and the smallest. So Atlantic, as you well know, was a boutique fixed income manager that we started. So from the ground up, and then, you know, working at some of the really big guys. And so you have this diverse approaches across different companies, different people, different personalities. And you, again, you learn from all of those. And, you know, it's been a great journey. You know, and they always talk about, you know, it's the journey, not the destination. So
let's talk about the journey, and let's start off with where it started. Where did you grow up, and what did you dream of career-wise when you were young?
So I grew up in Durban, which, you know, if you think about back to my era, and I'll probably define myself by saying, you know, I grew up in the era of the best music ever, which is the 80s.
I agree with you fully.
But I was born before that, so yeah, but it's a time when you sort of really start emerging in terms of your personality and that. Aspirationally, you're going to laugh at me, but I wanted to be a pilot. That was, for me, the greatest thing ever. And that persisted for me all the way through till what today would be grade 10. And then I sort of, you know, you started realizing you're getting career guidance counselors speaking to you and so forth and sort of saying, this is what you should do. And none of them said, being a pilot was one of the things they sort of said, you're not going to make money. So then I started thinking about, well, oh, is that what it's about? I better start thinking about what can make money. And I wouldn't say that after that, the post-pilot period of my life, if I can put it like that, that I really had one single aspiration in terms of what I wanted to do. So it wasn't like I had a calling to go and do investments. It was a sort of a roundabout trip that I had, which was, again, because of, you know, the subjects that I chose, good at maths, the usual story. So the career guidance counselor said, actuarial science. That's where it started. And I was very fortunate to get a bursary from Sanlam to study actuarial science. I went down to Cape Town from Durban. I wanted to go to Cape Town because it was the furthest place away from home. That's the sort of things you do at age 18. And then at the end of my first year, I went and did VAC work at Sanlam. And that was when I realized, oh, is that what actuaries do? And then I realized that's not quite what I sort of wanted to do.
Was that the insurance division, the people with the gray shoes?
100%, yes. So it was very much a case of, okay, I'm going to go through with this, but it's not where I want my career to go. And so then I ended up, you know, doing the actuarial science, but then also doing an honors in statistics. And that was what really ignited my sort of passion, which was also then realizing that what is it that I really want to do with my career? And that was when I realized investment is what I want to do.
What was your very first job in the investment world?
In the investment world, it was a quantitative analyst, so a junior quantitative analyst. Well, my very first job actually was a senior actuarial valuations assistant at Sanlam, where I learned to speak Afrikaans really fluently as well at Sanlam. But I had to wait. In 1990, the economy was pretty slow and it was in a recession and, you know, jobs were not easy to come by. So I had to wait for an opening in the investment department. And then eventually in 1992, I managed to get into the investment department.
And on a personal level, when did you make your very first investment, a personal investment, and can you remember what it was?
Yes, I can. I started probably at around about age 14, 15, there or thereabouts. I was fortunate because my mother actually worked at a bank, which also had a stockbroking arm to it as well. So what I realized was I saw my dad in particular, you know, reading the papers and always scanning through the, you know, the section that had all the shares in that. And so I started looking at them as well. And, you know, it was around about that time that you realized, okay, you've got to start making some money if you want to, you know, get ahead. And so then I started thinking about, well, what can I invest in? And obviously I didn't have the money to be able to buy stocks that were priced in those days, perhaps a couple of rand or whatever the case was, and you had to buy 100 of these shares. So in the end, what I thought is, well, penny stocks is the way to go. And I started looking at these things, and then I realized, okay, so there were some shares that, you know, are priced at 2 cents, and they'd go from 2 cents to 3 cents to 4 cents and then back to 2 cents. And then my mathematical brain was, well, if it goes from 2 cents to 4 cents, you've doubled your money, right? So I found this one particular stock that seemed to be sort of doing this, you know, this had this volatility. And it happened to be, I wish I could say it was the Geico, which Warren Buffett made a huge amount of money from, but it's something similar. It was called Gefco, which was a penny stock. And as it turns out, I suppose I'm going to get crucified now by the ESG specialist, because it was actually an asbestos mine in the Northern Cape, as it turned out. I didn't know anything about it, but I just looked at the share price. So you could say I started out by being a bit of a technical analyst investor by just looking at the price of the share going up and down. And that's what I did. I bought it. If it went to 4 cents, I sold it. When it came back to 2 cents, I bought it again. And that's how I started going.
And you made money from that strategy?
I made some money, and I didn't lose it all, as I would sort of, I didn't get to that stage where you sort of lose it all and sort of realize that you've got to find a better strategy. And then slowly but surely, I sort of started buying, you know, a couple of others in that. But that was the one that really stuck out for me was, you know, just essentially it's like you've got to have skin in the game. And I think that's the lesson also, because you start thinking differently then, right? Because if you're just looking at the number in the newspaper, I mean, we didn't have screens in those days to watch it, so you had to sort of look at the newspaper. You know, unless you have some skin in the game or you are at risk, you think differently. So for me, it was quite an important lesson.
So you took the paper, you looked at the share prices, you found one that was 2 cents. You didn't know what the company was doing. You invested in it and you made some money, as you've said. I would assume that strategy changed over the years.
Definitely, yes. I think what you sort of start realizing as you then, in particular once I left school and you start becoming plugged into, you know, what's going on in the global economy and based on what you're studying as well. I mean, as a student, you didn't really have much money. So I don't think I would say I sort of set the world alight in terms of investing during my studying career. But then once sort of started working and you could afford to start saving, then I sort of realized, okay, I'm now going to have a different strategy, and it's actually about saving. And so for me, when I look back to those days, and those were the days when, you know, you'd get to week three in the month and you would sort of have 10 rand left for the week. You know, there wasn't that much left over for saving. But I think the crucial thing that I learned in that time, when money was reasonably scarce because they didn't pay you well as a junior, was that you have to start somewhere. And so, you know, unit trust in their heyday, if you want to put it like that, you know, it sort of going into that sort of thing. So it was really about embracing diversified portfolios ultimately, and then just saying, saving for the long term, you're not allowed to touch this. And I think it was something like 50 rand a month that in those days you could invest into. It was sort of your minimum. And then there was that goal where, you know, technically they'd say, you know, rule of thumb, you must be saving 10% of your income through your sort of career if you can. I was well off the 10%, but I just said to myself, every time you get an increase, just increase it by a little bit more than the percentage increase that you got, so that over time, your proportion of saving actually then, you know, started going upwards. I don't think I ever quite hit 10%. And then eventually I sort of got to the stage where, and strange enough, that very unit trust that I originally started investing in, it was a Sanlam unit trust, and I still have that today. I've switched it from one fund to the other through the cycles and the years, but I've actually stuck with that all the way through. And to this day, I still have a debit order that goes off to Sanlam after 30 odd years.
And that is in addition, I would imagine, to your pension fund or RA contribution.
Yes, definitely.
You see, many young people who enter the job market, they are forced to belong to a pension fund. In many cases, they need to save and get a retirement annuity, and then it's a bit of a fire and forget strategy. And I think many young investors would like to get skin in the game, as you've said, because you think about the market a lot differently. And that is the discretional type of investments they make. Is there a difference in the way you should approach your discretionary investments as opposed to your saving for your retirement one day?
I think so. I mean, I think in particular for younger people who's starting out, you can take more risk, you know, outside of your sort of non-discretionary side of things. I think because you've got time is on your side, right? So you can afford to fail, if I can put it like that, in terms of and learn those lessons. So you can take sort of additional risk. And by that, what I'm not saying is sort of don't sort of, I'm not sort of saying you have these things of get rich quick type schemes and whatever cases. I'm talking about it's well thought out, but you can have, for example, one of the things as professional investors, we always sort of saying is, you know, avoid overly concentrated portfolio, et cetera, et cetera. So you want to look at diversification. They always say that's the free lunch, et cetera, et cetera. But I think in terms of the discretion, where you start saying, you know, if you have conviction around something, then sometimes it does pay off to actually, and again, for me, I work really sort of hard on that. You know, I'm not going to put all my eggs into one basket, but if I do have strong conviction around, you know, a particular stock or a particular theme or whatever the case is, you know, then, you know, I'm prepared to, you know, have fairly chunky bets around that in my sort of personal discretionary sort of savings.
So how do you approach it now? Obviously, you work for an asset manager. I know there are rules about personal investments at many of the asset managers, but how do you approach discretionary investments having had 3 decades or virtually 3 decades in the industry?
We can't escape the context of South Africa, right? And the economic growth and the paradigm that we live through here, which is that ultimately the economy has been stagnating. If you look at the returns of the last 10 years, for example, in the local equity market, they have essentially stagnated relative to the fixed income market. You know, at the moment, I'm busy presenting to clients in terms of a series where we look at this and sort of saying you're getting equity-like returns out of the fixed income market. But generally speaking, I haven't personally invested in the fixed income side of things. It's been about what do you do with your growth assets? And so for me, when I look at it from that context, of course, I have local exposure through pension fund investments and so forth. My discretionary side of things is pretty much all into the global markets. And so that's pretty much the approach that I've taken, which is that on the discretionary side is to go for the growth side of the equation. You have so much more choice offshore. You know, you can pick a company in South Africa and there'll be probably a better one somewhere in the world.
And do you invest directly into shares or through ETFs or unit trusts?
Generally speaking, I've got both, but generally speaking, with that discretionary side, I will actually go direct and stock pick. I mean, that's ultimately what I would do for that. I do try to think of myself as being thematic in terms of my approach. So looking at themes, I mean, the one that's sort of really, you know, driving markets at the moment, it would be AI. So it's to really sort of think it through really deeply and carefully and sort of say, well, what does that actually mean? You know, what do you want to back?
So is NVIDIA in your portfolio?
Yes, it is.
And when did you get in?
Probably went in, well, where are we? So it would have been at the beginning of this year, I think, actually. Yeah, it was early this year. And I will say this, is that in that particular instance with NVIDIA, because it's been on such a run, is that the strategy I followed is that you have to have a stop loss in place. And what I found was that, you know, as a professional investor, obviously also we have constraints in terms of what we can do in terms of trading. And you don't want sort of your personal trading to impact on your professional side of things. So there are constraints in terms of minimum holding periods and so forth. But in the case of if you have a stop loss that gets triggered, which it did do, I think 3 times already it got triggered because they're big swings in terms of the side of things. So for me, a stock like that where the valuations are so extended, and yes, we know all about the earnings and so forth, is that a stop loss can be a saving grace for you because, you know, especially if you're not watching it, my day job does not ask me to look at NVIDIA all day long. So it's one of those ones where my personal stuff I like to buy and hold mostly. Mm. But again, because of this particular, and it's a very powerful dynamic you do want to have a stop loss.
Can you just explain for a young investor who's now opened the Easy Equities account and wants to start trading, exactly how does a stop loss work and how do you pick the level at which you put that stop loss?
The way it would work generally is it's almost like an order that you put in the system before you actually trade, basically. So it's a standing order. So what happens is that if it's a trailing stop loss, it means that if the share is going up, and let's call it, say, where would I put the level to start with? The level generally, I would say, is somewhere like 10%. So as the stock goes up, if it hits a peak and it comes down 10%, then your stop loss is that 10% from the peak. And then you'll have an automatic sell. So if it carries on going, you're now out of the market. If it goes up, if it goes down to 10.5% down, so it breaks your stop loss, you sell, and it turns around and goes back up again, you miss out. So, you know, you need to constantly be aware of that if you want to stay in. And generally speaking, my rule of thumb would be something like a 10% stop loss, especially for a stock that has had such powerful momentum, you know, where it's been going up and up and up. You look at the valuation side of things, you know, Nvidia, if it's up 80%, you know, if you lose 10%, you know, you still net up.
But how does that tie in with normal market volatility? Warren Buffett will tell you, listen, just buy a great company. Don't pay too much for it and then keep it forever. Obviously, you will see some big swings in that share price over the years. So then you could lose out in the long term, not true?
100%. I think in this particular instance where AI is a new theme and it's unproven, if I can put it like that, in the sense of as a theme, does it have the legs? I think in the long run, yes. You know, I think that what you can see in the case of a company like NVIDIA that's almost priced to perfection, everybody says it's got a monopoly essentially in terms of those chips. Is that the case? It's probably a little bit too early to say at this point, because anywhere that there's this new theme that's emerged, obviously there are going to be competitors that are going to be coming in at some point in time. And, you know, again,
but we've seen the dot-com bubble in the late 90s. We've seen the financial services bubble in the late 2000s. We've seen a really volatile, you know, swings in especially the commodity sector in the 2010s. Well, I can add another one, that is the cannabis industry and biotechs, you know, at around 2020. All of them ran like crazy and then the bubble burst. Is AI different?
Probably not, because it's very tempting to say this time is different, right? If we look at the tech bubble bursting in 2000, I mean, if you know, look at Microsoft or the cases or Apple, you know, it would have been down 30-odd% at the time. Now you look back and you would have said that was just a little blip, right? So you can just ride it out. In my case, you know, given sort of where I am in the stage of my life and career, I probably don't want to be 30% down if I'm going with a sort of a chunky bet on something. So that's the reason why I would prefer to have a stop loss. If you're young, you're starting out, you can pick a great company, and there are many of them, and you can actually ride that volatility. If you're really worried about, you know, being, you know, 30% down, you know, then yes, rather use a stop loss. But if you're young, starting out, pick a stock, put it in a bottom drawer, and wait it out for 5 or 10 years.
Fire and forget.
Yes.
Now, let's talk about your big hits and misses. What has been the worst investment you have ever made? One which you don't really want to talk about.
There's been many. So I have to try and think of what the worst is. The one that I learned the most from in terms of losing money was actually LeisureNet, strangely enough, way back when. So for younger listeners, LeisureNet is the precursor to basically the Virgin Active. They owned the health and racket clubs.
But there was fraud involved, if I remember correctly.
I can't remember the details of that. Yeah, eventually it was on a tear upwards, and you just made hand over fist money, and everything looked good. And that was the problem, was that you never locked in anything. So I rode it all the way up and all the way down. And, you know, that was the lesson I learned there, which was that, you know, because as it's going down, you're thinking, okay, well, this is cheap, so let's buy some more, you know. And instead of looking at the proper fundamentals, this is a good over 25 years ago, I think it was. But that was a big lesson that I learned, which was it's not always buy and just hold forever. You know, I mean, I think there are many companies in South Africa that have had similar trajectories as well, where you can't just buy and hold. You actually do, as if you're going to be an investor, right? So I said, you know, we said fire and forget and buy NVIDIA and hold forever. It's not the case. I mean, you always have to do a review of what have you got is the investment case, the reason why you bought it in the first place, is it still valid, you know, in terms of its growth trajectory, et cetera, et cetera? If something's changed, you know, I think what the lesson I've learned is be quick to just pull the trigger, you know, and exit. You can always come back in again if you were wrong about the downside.
I think averaging can also play a role. Conversely, what has been your best investment, the one which you would also always brag about around the braai?
That's a tough one. I suppose I would say there's one that I've sort of stuck with sort of all the way through. In terms of decisions, again, the best ones that have been the ones where you go in and you exit at the top, and then that was it. And one of them was actually, well, Tesla was a good example for me of that, which was, I actually read the book on Elon Musk, and I thought, this guy's really onto something. Yeah, it's like, Tesla was already sort of on its way up. Bought Tesla. I probably, I don't know, doubled money in the space of 3-6 months, or whatever the case was. And then I looked at the valuations, and the Ford PE was like 600. And its market cap was bigger than, I think the things that they had at the time was like VW, Ford, whatever, all put together. And basically going to take over the motor industry in the world, in a sense. And I just thought, that's crazy. And then, you know, exited. I can't think, you know, where I've just sat for 20 years. You know, I think predominantly because of my career, and also online trading platforms in those days weren't as prevalent as what they are today. So it wasn't as easy to go offshore. So it was mostly local sort of stocks that we'd sort of focused on.
Anu, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your insights. I've learned a lot from this discussion, and hopefully the young professional investors can also take a few lessons and hopefully turn it into profits. But thank you so much for your time today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Greg.
That was Anu Lawrence. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Sasfin Asset Management.
Show me the money.
That was the Money Web, the A Better Investor podcast with Raik van Niekerk. Thanks for listening. Catch up and listen to all the Money Web podcasts on moneyweb.co.za or the app. Money Web, your trusted source for business and investment insights.